Well, I've often said that New Jerusalem was a wonderful community to grow up in. A lot of lovely people, very neighborly people, people that were most willing to help out in case of an emergency. I can remember in those days when the Depression, I was growing up during those early years of the Depression, of course, and I can remember the people coming to the door for a lunch. One of those chaps, an English chap, that used to tramp the roads and walk the rails and travel in boxcars, he wound up living in our community. My father took him in at one point and gave him work, and then he worked for some of the other neighbors. He wound up living in that community and died a few years after expropriation when he was living out in the Browns Flat area. People were very helpful and very close-knit, and I think that's still part of the reason why you see so many people getting together at special events. And I mentioned before that wherever you go, you're running into some of these people, the descendants of people that lived in the army camp area, not only our own community but the neighboring communities. And I have very, very good memories of growing up there as a teenager. I said we had a good water source in our farm. Well, I think there were three brooks at least that crossed our farm that you could fish in, and they all come together after a while down in the woods, and they went on to be joined by another brook or two, and we had excellent trout fishing in that area, and hunting and trapping. Those are some of the real nice memories that I have. Of course, that's where I shot some of my first game, and with an old 12-gauge shotgun that you had to be careful of. And several in my mother's family were hunters, and as a kid I always remember the hunting stories and them telling about how big the bucks were that they had shot and how big the ones were that they didn't shoot that got away, and how many they hauled home on the hand sled in the snow. And of course at that point in time the hunting season carried on to the end of November, so I guess when I heard stories about them bringing two and three big buck deer home on a toboggan or a hand sled, I guess they were true. But I have wonderful memories of my childhood in there, and it's like one fellow said, we didn't have any real games to play, but we made our own games and we made our own enjoyment. And of course that's stretching a little bit, because we did have dominoes and Chinese checkers and a few things like that, and lots of puzzles. But I think some of the most vivid memories I have are those moonlight nights out on the crust, or out on Beckett's Pond, or Webb's Pond, or somebody's pond, playing hockey in the moonlight with a small kid's rubber boot for a puck. We did use other things for pucks too, but I won't mention some of those.
Yeah, I understand. You went on, we've touched briefly on your career. Maybe you could give us a little more detail as to how you spent your life's work.
My career, as I said before, was close to 40 years in agriculture. I could use the term agrologist. That wouldn't mean as much to some people as agriculturalist, but to be more specific, I was involved in livestock promotional work, extension work. I worked for a year with the federal government in Ontario, and then I took transfer back here to the research station, and was involved in some animal research work there. But I could see right off the bat that research work was not where I wanted to be or wanted to go, and I needed to go back to school and get some more education. So I was given a good opportunity to switch over to the province, and I did that in 56. And I worked for 35 years in the same department, in the same branch, And that sort of thing is kind of not recommended and sort of unheard of in these times. Either I didn't have enough ambition to get out and try something else, or maybe they were satisfied with
maybe
the
you
job.
Maybe you were really good at what you did.
Maybe they were satisfied with the job I was doing. But I wound up the last 15 years of my career, I was in administration and director of the animal industry branch. I always, though, tried to keep in touch with what was going on out in the country. And in the type of work that we were doing, there were enough fairs and exhibitions and livestock sales and special things like that that we could find a reason to go out into the country to attend some of those. And as I used to say at times, I think that's the only way that I stayed sane, if I did, because I did not like being chained to a desk and working on budgets, and especially when it come to cutting budgets.
Yes.
And I'm glad I got out after 35 years. I've done some traveling. I've enjoyed life. I haven't hunted and fished as much as I said I was going to, but that's understandable, I guess. The more mileage you get on you, the less mobile you are. And I had a real good career, I would say.
Excellent.
I wouldn't change anything too much. I think if I was doing it over again, I would have probably learned to listen a little more and not talk quite so much.
That's probably a valuable lesson for government officials. And I think there's someone else special you wanted to mention before we carried on.
Oh yeah, during 15 of those years at work there, roughly, I met my present wife there at work, and we were married in 1990, and we'll be married 10 years this fall.
Okay.
And I just throw this in, I had no grandchildren, still no grandchildren to my original family. Well, when I remarried, there were 8 grandchildren, and pretty soon there were 10, and now there's a great-grandchild.
So
we have lots of lively times.
Excellent. That's good. To which organizations have you belonged throughout your life?
You're thinking about organizations in connection with my work and that sort of thing.
Any extracurricular?
I've not been a member of service clubs here in town. I haven't been a member. I was a member of our Institute of Agrology. That's a professional group.
Right.
And then at a national level, Canadian Society of Animal Science.
Right.
And on a national level, the Agricultural Institute of Canada. And for a long while, I was very closely involved working with several groups here in the province, breed associations and commodity groups, for example, Swine Association,
right.
Shorthorn Breeders Association, that type of thing. I've not been involved in any of the service clubs in town. After retirement, I got very much involved in the Fredericton Food Bank, 1 or 2 days a week. And more recently, I joined the Fredericton Golden Club, which is a group of senior men that meet every Wednesday morning. We sing O Canada to start with. We have a sing song. We have a little business meeting, very, very short, and we always have a speaker. And then on special occasions, we go out on little field trips, day trips, to look at something of interest to the group. Sometimes we have a picnic out at one of our members' camps. And this organization assists youth in the area in various ways by giving grants to help worthy individuals and worthy groups. And for instance, they are now supporting the Fredericton Food Bank too, and many other endeavors in town. In conjunction with Kiwanis, we carry on sale of cheese at Christmas time, and also help in the sale of Christmas trees. And some of these funds are going to assist youth in various projects here in the area.
Right.
And other than that, I've spent some time trying to assist and help some of older people, both relatives and friends, in their later years, especially where there's some opportunity to help to make life a little easier for them.
Right. Have you ever been?
And I should mention before I go on any further, I should mention my involvement here in church. I've been a member and supporter of Grace Memorial Baptist Church for many, many years. And I've served on several of the committees and boards there, including the Board of Finance and the Board of Missions, and also on I'm having trouble coming up with a name, not the entertainment board, but working in the kitchen. Spent quite a bit of time there helping out with suppers and that sort of thing.
Right.
So the involvement there has been very, very good and very meaningful. And I've helped usher and look after tellering. Have a teller team that's looking after the offering. Every 5 weeks, I guess it is now, we have to do our duty there.
Right.
So I find that that's quite meaningful to me over there.
Right. I'm going to ask you a philosophical question now. If there was a piece of advice that you could pass along to anyone who might listen to this, or a friend or a relative or what have you, what would that one piece of advice be based on your life?
Well, I know when I was going to college, I saw a motto one time that that went something like this, that a fellow should so live that when he dies, even the undertaker would feel sorry. Now, I know I haven't measured up to that objective, but I've always felt that going along through life, a fellow should try to do some good along the way, try to help somebody in need, and try to have some effect on things around you to improve them or leave them in a better state than what you found them. Right at the moment, I feel kind of bad about what is happening in agriculture here in the province, and the lack of emphasis that our government is placing on agriculture with all the cuts. And many of my good friends are losing their jobs right now, and I feel very bad about that. I've always been a supporter of farm groups and some kind of a united effort to try to make things better, and a supporter of youth and the 4-H movement, and I just have concerns right at the moment about what's taking place there.
Okay.
I hope that when everything shakes down in a matter of a very short period of time, that that things will work out. But I've now been retired 9 years. I guess you know, I'm a has-been in some respects. I'm not bilingual and I'm not computerized, so in today's world there's not much place left for some of us people, but we can still have a little fun and surely help people a little bit along the way.
Right. I'm sure you're underestimating your importance, but I once heard it said that the hardest working man on earth was the Canadian farmer. Would you agree?
Well, the Canadian farmer certainly operates under the influence of a lot of factors, and with the uncertainty sometimes of what market situations are going to be. Nowadays it's global competition. It isn't just regional or Canadian, it's global. I've always had a great respect for farmers and rural people, farm families, for the hard work that they have done and for the odds that they sometimes are up against. A farmer can have his crop wiped out in the matter of minutes with a hailstorm.
Mm-hmm.
An infestation of insects. Weather is a factor that we can't do anything about. We have to take it as it is and make the best of it. My father always used to say that if it rained on St. Swithin's Day, I think it was the 13th of July, it would rain for a month afterwards, and I know we experienced that in haymaking days.
Yeah.
And I think they have this year too, in some cases.
So, to move back once again, the day you would have found out about the expropriation, you would have been away at school.
I was away. We'd heard rumors. There'd been people around looking over the area, and we had heard rumors, and nobody could honestly believe that that sort of thing would take place. Even after they started to hold some meetings to inform people a bit, some people just said it'll never happen. There'll be a lot of opposition to this. There was opposition, but some people didn't care. Some people wanted to take the quick dollar for their woodlot or their property and get going. A lot of the young people were moving away anyway to find employment. They were going to where the fields were apparently greener. And I often wonder what would have happened if expropriation hadn't have taken place. Where there was a dozen people farming small farms before, there might have been one now farming. There probably would have been a mill or two in the area. People would have been involved in trucking. There could have been a few farms in that whole area that would have been producing fluid milk, the same as farmers are today in other regions, instead of producing cream for a butter factory. But if some people had have shown as much opposition as some of my relatives, there'd have been quite a showdown, I think.
Give us an idea of the
even
type
when,
of...
Even when the tanks were tearing around in the fields in there in the spring of 54, my aunt, Elsie Inch, was out in the driveway denying them entry to her driveway and her roadway there. So she never did quite get over that move. It was very, very difficult for them, and as it was for a lot of people in midlife or later years to pick up and get out of a community, family, friends, churches, churchyards, graveyards, what have you. You know, the community spirit, community hall, that sort of thing.
The church,
the picnics, the ball games, the dances, and all that sort of thing. And to involve 700 families in a dozen and a half communities, that's a lot of people.
Who made the phone call to you?
To tell me? Oh, I can't really remember that. I think it would just came through my own family that that this would... And when I would have been home during some break, I would, even in the fall of... In the fall of 1952, I came home at Thanksgiving time. Another chap and I drove down from Ontario. And that's when things were starting to get really talked up, eh? And I wrote letters about it at the time. After the expropriation, some people said what a great thing it was. And it sure was a boost to the economy of Southern NB.
Right.
There's no question about that. And it made a lot of employment for a lot of people over the years. A lot of natives in the Oromocto, St. John River Valley, Hoyt, Tracy, a lot of people got employment during the building phase and then later on as maintenance people. And I just talked to a chap on the weekend that had spent a good many years down on maintenance crews working on the roads in the camp area. And he'd been all through our home area. We had a good chat about it. Just while we're talking about this, I'll make one comment. One of my friends said after the expropriation that he was in Ottawa one day and he met one of the chaps that was one of the key players in the expropriation or the settlement of the properties with the individuals. And that man, this was a few years after expropriation, he confessed that they got away with murder, and he said they operated without proper legislation in some cases to do what they were doing. He said, we could never do it again. If we tried to do that again, we could never do it. Mm-hmm. Because it was, it was, some people call it, instead of expropriation, they call it expulsion.
Yeah. How did your father react?
Well, my father was just in his early 50s and had some heart trouble. They didn't like it. They didn't like having to go out and start to search for a new home at that stage of a life. And they spent many, many hours and put on many miles looking at properties all over the southern part of the province, Kings County in particular. And he eventually wound up not buying another farm. He just bought a small acreage, still kept some livestock for a little while. And he took on a job as a greenskeeper or worker at the Westfield Golf and Country Club.
Really?
And I think he really enjoyed those years.
Yes, sir.
It was the first time in many, many years that he'd worked for somebody else. And I'm sure even the work out in the sun and the labor at times probably was tiresome. I think he really enjoyed working out with other people and having a few years to do that.
Right.
And actually he worked there at the golf club I guess the day before he died.
Yes, sir. So you would have come home from school after school was over to help your parents move.
Well, I'd been working in Ontario that first year after school.
Okay.
From 52 through 53, and I remember distinctly I drove a half-ton truck back from Ontario, and we were going to use this to haul some stuff. And I wanted the truck anyway, and this was an excuse we could use it, you know, to move with. And it was the year of the coronation of the present queen, I remember that, mm-hmm. Spring of 53. And I came home and worked here at the research station, but I had the weekends and some holidays to help my folks move out in the spring of 54.
Right. And where did you move them to?
Moved them just down the river road below Brown's Flat, a place called Greenwich Hill.
Okay.
If you know anything about that river road, there's a hill they call the Devil's Back Hill.
Right.
And they live just down near the bottom of the Devil's Back Hill.
Quite a place to give directions to. So, would you say your family was better off or worse off because of the expropriation?
Financially, there were some people in there that didn't get paid enough for a lifetime of endeavor and work in building up a farm and a good set of farm buildings and a comfortable surrounding. At the time, it seemed like maybe a pretty good sum of money. I know they got more than what farms were selling for in that area at that time. I know they got more than that. But the big question is, was that enough compensation to make them feel good about it? Very few people felt very good about it, I think, but for some people it was a relief. They were able to get rid of their places, they got some money in their pocket, and they could go do something else and work for somebody else, or in the case of some older people, take life a little easier and retire. My father held on to the bitter end. He wouldn't settle, and he wouldn't settle, and of course, by not doing so, he got a little bit of interest money on what they had agreed to earlier, and finally they did. They come back and done some reappraisal, and they did raise the offer a little bit, and I know I encouraged them to take. I can remember definitely the day that I went up from the research station, met him uptown over in Queen Street where Mr. Miller's office was, and I said, I think, Dad, maybe, you know, the time has come, you better settle. Few people didn't. Few people let it go and go and go.
Really?
So long after expropriation, before they made their final settlement. There weren't many people in that category, but... Some people would say, yes, they were better off. I never heard my people say they thought they were better off, but in some ways they probably were, because they moved it was an older place, and they had to spend quite a bit of money on it, renovations and so on, but they had inside plumbing, and they bought some new appliances, and they bought a TV, and had a good car, and went to church and worked a little, but didn't travel. They didn't want to travel.
Yes, sir. Content at home.
I took my father once to Toronto to the Royal Winter Fair, and that he always wanted to go out west to visit one of his brothers that worked in Western Canada, or that went there and farmed and homesteaded and farmed there and raised a big family, and my father never got out there. And my mother didn't want to travel, even as a widow, and she had sisters she could have traveled with, but she didn't want to travel.
Yes.
They were very, very happy to be at home.
Do you ever wonder, perhaps, if the Army base had not moved in there, that perhaps you yourself might own some land down there to this day?
Yes. I would have had some woodland for sure. I'd have wanted some land to hunt and fish on, that's for sure.
Right.
I doubt if I'd have been back there farming myself. One of my brothers, the brother next to myself, Floyd, didn't have much interest in the farm at that point anyway. He was more interested in machinery and trucks and working out. I've often thought about that. I've always wanted to own a little block of land somewhere and have some woodland, but it always seemed that I never got around to doing it. It's my own fault, I suppose. But what happened here back a few years ago, the big companies started gobbling up land, and it made it impossible to buy some of this land. With mm-hmm. I couldn't do it on a civil service salary. And then in more recent times, when I wanted a place down on the river, foreign interests came in and started buying up property. And anything that had water frontage was going for pretty good money, and especially if there was a view. And that put me right out of the market completely. So I don't own any property outside of town.
Right. Have you ever gone back to the old...
Oh, I go back all the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We go back every summer. In July, we usually meet in there and have a little get-together and a picnic, you know, take some potluck. Well, most everybody takes their own thing, you know, and mm-hmm. share a little bit, and go in and meet by the cenotaph. And just as recent as 5 or 6 years ago, we'd go in and have a ball game. And
really?
And... we'd try to get them to scrape up the old diamond, but they'd usually leave it with sods and rocks, so it was sort of unsafe to play on. Uh-huh. I think I'll always remember this, and it was back about 5 or 6 years ago. We had a little ball game going on there, and I was, I guess, supposed to be capped on the one team. And I got looking around, and I had three fellows in the field that had all had open-heart surgery. So I said, boys, look... you know, this is only a fun game, you know, don't get serious about this. And if the ball's hit the one side of you over your head, don't run after it.
Let it go.
And I know I was having trouble with cataracts on my eyes at that particular time, and one of my friends struck me out about two or three times, and I said, I'll get you next year after I get those cataracts off. Yeah. And I think the next year I got on base two out of three times.
Yes, sir. Mr. Johnson, I'm just going to give you this opportunity to perhaps recap on anything, or if I've jogged your memory on anything to express it here.
Well, I just like to reinforce what I've already talked about, that our community was a wonderful community to grow up in. I had some wonderful playmates and later on real good friends, and friends that would stick with you, and for the most part it was a pretty law-abiding community. There was a few fellas that liked to jack like deer, and we sometimes took a few more trout home than we were supposed to, but they were all made use of, you know. There was nothing went to waste. And this bit about the close-knitness of the community, and I don't know, it just seemed that neighbors were always ready to help one another, and were lovely occasions when the neighbors all got together to help at a wood cutting episode, I'll call it. Somebody owned the wood cutting machine and the motor, and they moved, or the engine, they moved it around from one farm to another, and the neighbors all helped saw the wood. And the same thing happened with thrashing the grain in the fall of the year, early winter. My father's uncle owned a thrashing machine, a wood cutting machine, Mr. Jim Johnson, and he moved these around from place to place, and everybody got together and helped out, and these were just wonderful get-togethers. And of course they had big meals at that time, and I can remember just as a kid getting involved in some of those and enjoying the meals. I don't know, you know, there's no point of trying to compare anything then with nowadays, because things have changed so much. As one fellow said, we made our own fun, we made our own games. He said when we were kids, if we couldn't think of something to do, we'd climb trees. Somebody else took the slingshot and went hunting squirrels. And that's the way it was. And I have some awful pleasant memories of that community and growing up in that kind of an environment.
Well, Mr. Johnson, I'd say that type of environment produced a very well-groomed man. And I thank you very, very much for sharing your story with us and helping us, or giving us this link to the past. Thank you very much.